Hi, my name is Alex. My echo boomeranged back at me with such force it almost knocked me off balance. And I'm from Los Angeles. Mr. Buffett, I've heard that one of your ways of focusing your energy is that you write down the 25 things you want to achieve, choose the top 5, and then avoid the bottom 20. I'm really curious how you came up with this and what other methods you have for prioritizing your desires. Well, Buffett replied, chuckling, I'm actually more curious how you came up with it. A deafening roar of laughter came from the crowd. It's hard to explain what it feels like when an entire stadium of people laughs at you at once. It really isn't the case, Buffett said. It sounds like a very good method of operating, but it's much more disciplined than I actually am. If they stick fudge down in front of me, he pointed to the box of C's, I eat it. I felt my face turning red under the spotlight. Charlie and I live very simple lives, Buffett added. But we know what we do enjoy, and we now have the option of pretty much... Charlie likes to design buildings. He's no longer a frustrated architect. He's a full-fledged architect now. And, you know, we both like to read a lot. But I've never made a list. I can't recall making a list in my life. But maybe I'll start, Buffett said, triggering even more laughter. You've given me a great idea. In an instant, the spotlight shut off. I staggered back to my seat, unable to make sense of what happened. What I could make sense of were all the whispers and chuckles I heard as I passed through the aisles. I kept my head down, trying to avoid eye contact. After I settled in my seat, Kevin leaned over and brought up a good point. Our first two questions probably surprised Buffett, and if we wanted to get a good answer out of him, the next one needed to be simple and straightforward. I agreed, and we both pulled Brandon aside and told him his question needed to be completely clear, so Buffett would have no choice but to answer it. Kevin and I then stepped into the hallway with Brandon so he could practice projecting his voice and enunciating every word. We returned to our seats, and soon enough, Brandon was at the mic. Hi, I'm Brandon from Los Angeles. It was the clearest sentence I could have asked for. The problem was Brandon was so clear and enunciated so slowly it sounded suspicious. If I'm in my 20s and I'm starting a partnership, what advice do you have about getting people to put in money before I have a track record as a solo investor? There was a pause. Well, Buffett said, you haven't sold me. Another wave of laughter shot from the crowd. I wondered if Buffett had caught on to what was going on. Here was another 20-something, also wearing jeans, also from Los Angeles, also at Station 8, and also asking another unusually specific question that had nothing to do with Berkshire's recent performance. I think people should be quite cautious about investing money with other people, Buffett said, even when they have a track record, incidentally. There are a lot of track records that don't mean much, but overall, I would advise any young person who wants to manage money and wants to attract money later on to start developing an audited track record as early as they can. I mean, it was far from the sole reason that we hired Ted and Todd, who manage investments for Berkshire, but we certainly looked at their record, and we looked at a record that Charlie and I both believed and could understand because we see a lot of records that we don't really think mean much. If you have a coin flipping contest and you get 310 million orangutans out there and they all flip coins, and they flip them 10 times, you'll have 300,000 roughly that flipped heads 10 times in a row successfully. And Those orangutans will probably go around trying to attract a lot of money to back them in future coin flipping contests. So, it's our job, when we hire somebody to manage money, to figure out whether they've been lucky coin flippers or whether they really know what they're... Well... A voice cut Buffett off. When you had this problem, didn't you scrape together about $100,000 from your loving family? It was Charlie Munger. Oh, yeah, Buffett said. Well, I hope they kept loving me after they gave me the money. Buffett chuckled again. Well, he continued stammering. It was, very slow, and it should have been slow. As Charlie had pointed out, some people thought I was running a Ponzi scheme, probably. And other people may not have thought it, but it was to their advantage to sort of scare people because they were selling investments in Omaha. To attract money, you should deserve money. And you should develop a record over time that does it. You should explain to people why that record is a product of sound thinking rather than simply being in tune with a trend or simply just being lucky. Charlie, you're starting in the game and you're 25 years old, Munger repeated with a sense of thoughtfulness in his voice. How do you attract money? I'll never know what Charlie Munger was thinking, but perhaps he too noticed Buffett wasn't giving us straight answers. I felt like Munger was saving me from another round of humiliation. He said that the best way to raise money before you have a track record is to do it from people who already believe in you and trust you because they've seen you do other things in the past. Those people can be family, friends, college professors, former bosses, or even the parents of your friends. It's hard to do it when you're young, Munger added, and that's why people start so small. Munger and Buffett's conversation veered off to hedge funds, and then they moved on to the next question. Brandon returned to his seat. Although he had to endure some laughter, at least we had gotten a response. We had one more shot. It was up to Corwin. After Buffett fielded a question from Station 7, Corwin headed to the mic. The journalist asked a question, then the analyst. The spotlight flashed on Station 8. Corwin was leaning in, holding the sheet of interview questions with one hand, pulling up his sagging pants with the other. He began asking the question, but I couldn't hear him. His microphone was shut off. Buffett's voice boomed. We'll take a 5 minute or so recess. Thank you for coming, and I hope to see you next year. Just like that, Buffett ended the Q&A. Corwin just stood there, under the spotlight, holding up his pants. My friends and I made our way out of the arena, overwhelmed with confusion and defeat. As we moved through the crowded halls, people stared at me. One guy patted me on the back and said, "Nice question, pal. I needed a good laugh." Out on the sidewalk, people were still snickering at me. Kevin put a hand on my shoulder. "Don't let them get to you," he said. We walked on in silence. A few minutes later, Kevin gently spoke again. "It doesn't make sense. How could you have been so off with your question?" "I wasn't off," I shot back. "It was Buffett who was off." I told Kevin about the avoidance list and how I had met Dan, how he had promised to get me to Buffett, about the stories he had shared about working for Buffett, and about Dan's ideas to make the website and send the shoe. Kevin began to squint. "How could Buffett say he doesn't know about the avoidance list?" I said, holding myself back from screaming. "I can't believe Buffett would lie like that." Kevin just looked at me and said, "What if it wasn't Buffett who lied?" Chapter 23. Mr. King! I soon learned that Kevin was right. Shortly after the shareholders meeting, Dan's girlfriend called and told me she'd been getting suspicious about him too. She contacted Buffett's assistant, who revealed that Dan never worked directly for Buffett. I couldn't believe it. When I called Dan, he denied it, and then he suddenly asked if anyone else was on the call listening to our conversation. I told him no, and when I asked him more about his background, the conversation filled with tension. He answered my questions, but the details didn't add up. Dan hung up, and it was the last time we ever spoke. Never before had I felt so betrayed. This wasn't just a stranger with a lie. This was someone I had trusted, someone I cared about. That's what made the pain sear so deep. Perhaps this was something I needed to learn the hard way. Some people are not who they say they are. My problem was that I had been so desperate to get to Buffett that I ignored the red flags about Dan that had popped up all around me. The lesson was clear. Desperation clogs intuition. At the same time, I hadn't been transparent either. I had an agenda from the moment I had met Dan. The only reason I befriended him was to get to Warren Buffett. When I was on Dan's boat in San Francisco, I put him on the spot in front of his girlfriend. Although he twisted the truth, he never would have kept pushing the lie if I didn't keep pulling on it. My strategizing and lack of transparency backed him into a corner. Dishonesty breeds dishonesty. My gloom was unshakable after I returned to LA from Omaha. A short time later, Corwin was trying to lift my spirits as we sat on a curb one afternoon eating sandwiches in front of a grocery store.
"Dude," Corwin said, his mouth full, "I know you're upset, and I don't blame you, but at a certain point you have to let it go and move on."
I sighed, then bit into my sandwich.
"You've got to get back to your routine," he went on. "Don't you have any other interviews lined up?"
"I've got nothing," I said. "And even if I did, I'd probably screw it up. Look what happened at the shareholders meeting. When I sent Andre up with that persuasion question, I packed it with so many details, it turned Buffett against us. Not only can I not get an interview, I don't even know how to interview."
"You've got to stop being so hard on yourself," Corwin said. "Interviewing isn't easy. It's more than just asking questions. It's an art."
As we continue talking, the most inexplicable coincidence of my journey occurred. A black Lincoln with tinted windows pulled up to the curb and parked in front of us. The door swung open, and out came Larry King. One of the most iconic interviewers in the world was walking into the grocery store right in front of me, and he was all alone. Larry King's show on CNN had run for 25 years. He'd interviewed more than 50,000 people over his lifetime. Why hadn't I tried to track him down before? I knew he lived nearby, and it was practically public knowledge where he ate breakfast every day. But I sat motionless, watching him walk away through the store's sliding doors.
"Dude," Corwin said, "go talk to him."
I felt like I had sandbags on my shoulders.
"Just go into the grocery store," Corwin pressed.
I wasn't sure if I was dealing with a flinch or if I was just depleted from 6 months of rejection and humiliation.
"Come on," Corwin said, nudging my shoulder, pushing me to stand. "He's 80 years old. How far could he have gone?"
I lifted myself off the sidewalk and walked through the store's sliding doors. I glanced around the bakery. No Larry. I jogged to the produce section. Towers of colorful fruits, walls of vegetables. No Larry. That's when I remembered he had parked in a loading zone. He must be leaving any minute now.
I ran to the back of the store and dashed across the aisles, turning my head down each one. No Larry, no Larry, no Larry, no Larry. I cut a sharp left, dodged a tower of canned tuna, and sped down the frozen food section. I sprinted to the front of the store and looked at every register. Still, no Larry. I stopped myself from kicking a stray shopping cart. Once again, I had blown it. When Larry King had been right in front of me, I didn't do a thing. As I moped through the parking lot, I lifted my gaze, and right in front of me, 30 feet away, was Larry King, suspenders and all. In that moment, all the pent-up anger and energy inside me began to combust, erupting from my mouth, causing me to yell at the top of my lungs, "Mr. King!" Larry's shoulder shot straight up. His head slowly turned around. His eyebrows arched toward his hairline. His mouth gaped open, and every wrinkle on his face sprung back. I sprinted toward him and said, "Mr. King, my name is Alex. I'm 20 years old. I've always wanted to say hi." He lifted a hand. "Okay, hi." Then speed walked away. I followed in silence until we were finally out on the sidewalk in front of his car. He unlocked the trunk, stuffed in his groceries, opened the driver's side door, and was about to climb inside, so I yelled again, "Wait, Mr. King!" He looked at me. Can I go to breakfast with you?" He looked around. A dozen people were on the sidewalk watching the scene unfold. Larry took a heavy breath and then said in his gravelly Brooklyn voice, "Okay, okay, okay." I said thank you as he clicked his seatbelt. Before he shut the door, I called out, "Wait, Mr. King, what time?" He looked at me, then slammed the door. "Mr. King," I shouted through the glass, "what time?" He turned on the engine. I was now standing in front of his car, flailing my arms in front of the windshield. "Mr. King, what time?" He glared at me, then at the crowd, then shook his head and said, "9 o'clock, and then drove off. I arrived at the restaurant the next morning. Larry King was in the first booth, hunched over a bowl of cereal, sitting with a few other men. Above their table was a large silver picture frame with photos of Larry interviewing Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Jerry Seinfeld, Oprah Winfrey, and more. There was an open seat at the table, but because I was embarrassed about how I had acted the prior day, I didn't want to boldly pull back the chair and plop down. So from a distance, I gently waved a hand and said, "Hi, Mr. King. How are you?" He acknowledged me with a lift of his head, mumbled gruffly, and then turned back to his friends. I assumed he wanted me to come back in a few minutes, so I took a seat at the table next to him, waiting to be called over. 10 minutes passed. 30. An hour. Finally, Larry stood up and stepped toward me. I could feel my cheeks lifting. But then he walked right past me and headed for the exit. I lifted my hand. Mr. King? "What is it?" he said. "What do you want?" A sharp, familiar pain shot through my chest. "Honestly," I said, "I just wanted some advice on how to interview people." Then, a slow smile spread across his face. It was as if his eyes were saying, "Why didn't you say so before?"
"All right," he said. "Sometimes when people are starting out and they feel they don't know how to interview people, they look to the people they admire. Maybe it's Barbara Walters or Oprah or myself. And they see how we interview, and they try to copy that. That's the biggest mistake you can make. You're focused on what we're doing, not why we're doing it."
He explained that Barbara Walters asks thoughtful questions that are strategically placed. Oprah uses loads of enthusiasm and emotion. And he asks the simple questions that everyone wants to ask.
"When young interviewers try to copy our styles, they're not thinking about why we have these styles. The reason why is because these are the styles that make us the most comfortable in our seats. And when we are the most comfortable in our seats, our guests are the most comfortable in their seats. And that's what makes for the best interviews. The secret is, there is no secret.
There's no trick to being yourself. He checked his watch.
Listen, kid, I really gotta go.
He looked me in the eye, then shook his head again as though debating something in his mind. He put a finger in my face and said,
All right, Monday, 9 o'clock. See you here.
When I showed up on Monday, all the seats were taken at Larry's table, but he waved me over anyway and asked why I was so interested in interviewing. I told him about the mission, and as soon as I asked if I could interview him, he said,
All right, I'll do it.
We talked a bit more about the mission. Then he said he had someone he wanted me to meet.
Hey, Cal,
he said, turning to one of his friends at the table.
Can you give this kid a few minutes?
Cal wore a sky blue fedora with horn-rimmed glasses. He seemed to be in his 50s, decades younger than the rest of Larry's crew. Larry told me that Cal Fussman was a writer at Esquire, where he had interviewed Muhammad Ali, Mikhail Gorbachev, George Clooney, and dozens of other icons for the magazine's What I've Learned column. Larry asked Cal to share some more interview advice with me. After Cal and I peeled off to a nearby table, I told him about my prior interviews. No matter how much I prepare, I said, things don't go the way I plan, and I can't figure out why.
How are you doing your interviews? Cal asked.
He nodded along as I told him I spent weeks, sometimes months, researching my questions. Then, his eyelids narrowed when I said I brought my notepad filled with questions into the sessions.
Are you bringing your notepad because it relaxes you? He asked. Or because you're afraid that without it, you won't know what to ask?
I'm not sure, I said. I've never thought about that.
Okay, let's try something, Cal said. Come back to breakfast tomorrow. You'll have a seat at the table. Don't think of it as an interview. Just eat breakfast and relax.
I spent every day the next week doing exactly that. Each morning, I sat next to Cal and watched how Larry ate his Cheerios with blueberries, how he pushed his bowl away after he ate the final blueberry, no matter how much cereal was left, how Larry talked on his flip phone, how he interacted with strangers who came over to say hello and ask for a picture. Larry couldn't have been kinder to each of them, which made me wonder how crazy I must have looked when I chased him in front of that grocery store. At the end of the week, Cal told me to bring my audio recorder to breakfast the next day.
But leave your notepad at home, he said. You're comfortable now. Just sit at the table and let your curiosity ask the questions.
The following morning, everyone was in their usual positions. Larry sat across from me, hunched over his Cheerios. To his right was Sid, one of Larry's best friends for more than 70 years. Next was Brucey, who went to middle school with them, Barry, who also grew up with them in Brooklyn, and then there was Cal, with his sky blue fedora. I was halfway through my omelet when I asked Larry how he got started in broadcasting.
When we were kids, Sid said, jumping in, Larry used to roll up sheets of paper, pretend it was a microphone, and announce the Dodger games.
When Larry described movies, Barry added, his descriptions took longer than the actual movie. Larry's dream was to be a radio broadcaster, he told me, but he didn't know how to get started. After graduating high school, he worked odd jobs, delivering packages, selling milk, working as a bill collector, until one afternoon, when he was 22 years old, Larry and a friend were walking down the street in New York City when they bumped into a man who worked at CBS.
He was the guy who hired radio announcers, Larry said. He was also the guy who announced between shows, This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Larry asked him for advice on how to break into the industry. The man advised him to go down to Miami, where a lot of stations were non-union and had open slots. Larry jumped on a train to Florida, slept on a relative's couch, and began searching for a job.
I just knocked on doors, Larry said. There was this small station where I took a voice test, and they said, You sound pretty good. Next opening, you've got the job. So I hung around the station. I watched people read the news. I learned. I swept the floors. Then one day, a guy quit on a Friday, and they told me, You start Monday morning.
I stayed up all weekend, nervous as hell.
Wait, what do you mean by you knocked on doors? I asked. How did you do that?
Larry looked at me like I was in preschool.
Bang, 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 he said, pounding his knuckles on the table.
It isn't a figure of speech, Sid said.
Larry knocked on the doors of different radio stations. He introduced himself and asked for a job. That's what we did in those days.
That's all I could do, Larry said. I didn't have a resume. I didn't go to college.
Okay, I get that that's what you did back then, I said. But if you were starting out today, what would you do?
Same thing, Larry said. I'd knock on doors. I'd knock on whatever doors I'd have to. There'd be many more places to knock.
And look, nothing is new. We have the internet, but nothing is new except the transmission. Human nature hasn't changed.
Cal explained that it's still a human being making the hiring decisions. Only after looking you in the eye can someone get a sense if you're genuine. You may be using the same words in an email, but it's a different experience in person.
People like human beings, Cal said. People don't like random names in their inbox.
It dawned on me that when Spielberg gave me that early encouragement, when Elliot took me to Europe, or when Larry finally invited me to breakfast, those moments happened only after I met them in person and looked them in the eye. Wait a minute. For the past year, I had been a random name inside Bill Gates' chief of staff's inbox. He took that original phone call with me because Chilu had asked as a favor, not because he knew me. I had taken it personally when the chief of staff stopped replying to me, but it wasn't personal at all. I was just a random name to him. And I knew exactly how to fix that.
Chapter 24, The Final Bullet. 4 weeks later, Long Beach, California. I pulled back a chair at the lobby espresso bar of the Westin Hotel. I was at the main lodging for the TED conference, and over the course of my journey, I had never been in such a perfect position. As I looked around, a wave of deja vu washed over me. In the dining area 20 feet away was the table where I'd had my first meal with Elliot. That meeting with Elliot had taken place 1 year earlier, almost to the day. The timing was so eerie, it felt like fate was smiling upon me. My mood was high to begin with because minutes earlier, I had just finished having breakfast with Tony Hsieh. When he had heard why I was at the Westin, he invited me to watch the TED live stream in his RV parked in front of the hotel. But all this hadn't come together easily. 4 weeks earlier, I had reached out to Stephen Weitz, my inside man at Microsoft. I knew Bill Gates' chief of staff attended TED every year. So I asked Stephen if I could meet with the chief of staff at the event for 5 minutes in person. If this didn't work, I swore to Stephen I would never ask again. This was my final bullet. Stefan agreed and sent the chief of staff email after email for weeks. When he didn't get a reply, he even had one of his colleagues email the chief of staff. Stefan's generosity had always been astonishing, but this time, it left me speechless. The day before the conference, Stefan still hadn't received a response. Then, at 7:27 p.m. the night before, a reply arrived. Yes, the chief of staff said, he'd be at TED. And yes, he'd like to see me. He said he'd meet me after the conference's first session around 10:15 at the lobby espresso bar. Now, here I was, looking up at the clock on the wall. It read 10:14 a.m.
Sir, the barista said, what can I get for you?
Just a minute, please, I said. My guest should be here any moment. A short while later, the barista was in front of me again, asking if I was ready to order. I glanced up. 10:21 a.m.
Sorry, I said. He must be running late. Just a few more minutes, please.
I looked across the lobby and scanned the faces emerging from the rotating glass door. The next time I looked at the clock, they read 10:31 a.m. My gut sensed something was wrong, but I brushed it off. The conference's session was probably running behind. Time began to slow. Then I heard again,
"Sir, are you going to order?"
It was 10:45 a.m. The bar stools next to me were still empty. After all I had been through, after everything I did to get to this point, this is how it was going to end? I pulled up an old email from the chief of staff's assistant and called her office line, forcing myself to take deep breaths.
"Hi, Wendy, it's Alex Benayan. I know we had this 10:15 appointment today, and I'm sure he's really busy. I'm grateful he even gave me an appointment, but I just wanted to make sure everything's okay. It's been 30 minutes now, and he hasn't shown up."
"What are you talking about?" she said. "He called me and said you didn't show up."
"What?"
Apparently, there were two lobby espresso bars, one at the hotel and one at the convention center, and I was at the wrong one. I clutched my phone and tried to hold myself together, but I couldn't. Tears formed in my eyes as I poured my heart out to Wendy, explaining everything I had gone through the past 2 years to get this meeting.
Okay, she said. "Give me a little time. Let me see what I can do."
An hour later, I got an email from Wendy. She said the chief of staff was going to the airport that afternoon at 4:30 p.m. His town car would be in front of the Westin valet, and he had agreed to have me ride with him to the airport and talk in the car. I was too drained to throw a fist in the air, but I still felt a faint smile on my face. This time, I knew there was only one Westin valet. I passed the time inside Tony Shea's RV, watching the TED livestream on a flat-screen TV, and then going out for lunch with Tony's friends. On my way back, I traced the route from the Westin valet to the RV, timing it at just about a minute. I set my phone alarm for 4:10 p.m., guaranteeing I would get there early. As I lounged on a soft brown couch in Tony's RV, a man stepped onto the bus. The sun shined through the window behind him, so all I saw was a silhouette. He slowly lowered himself onto the couch across from me. His face looked familiar. He was an older man with thin white hair, a white beard, and a round belly. I looked closer, and that's when I realized this was Richard Saul Warman, the founder of TED.
"You," he said, looking my way. "What do you think of this thing?"
He was pointing to the TV displaying the live stream. The founder of TED was literally asking me what I thought of his conference. I shared with him what I thought, and before I knew it, he was telling me the entire story of how he started TED. He enthralled me with story after story, and I felt like I had broken the wisdom pinata and was trying to stuff as many nuggets into my pocket as possible.
"You want to know the secret to changing the world? Stop trying to change it. Do great work and let your work change the world. You won't get anywhere significant in life until you come to the epiphany that you know nothing. You're still too cocky. You think you can learn anything. You think you can speed up the process. How does one become successful? You'll get the same answer if you ask that to any other older, wiser, and more successful person. You have to want to do it very, very badly. I don't understand why people give speeches with slides. When you speak with slides, you become a caption. Never be a caption. I live my life by two mantras. One, if you don't ask, you don't get. And two, most things don't work out." My phone was blaring. It was 4:10, but he was talking 100 miles a minute, and there was no way to excuse myself without cutting him off. His insights were so good, I didn't want to leave. Plus, I couldn't just walk out on the founder of TED. Whatever, I thought. I'll just hit snooze this one time. He kept going and going and going, and then... He kept talking over the alarm. It was like I was on an express train with no local stops. I felt I couldn't just leave while he was mid-story, and the Westin Valley was only a minute away. All right, I'll hit snooze just one more time. I kept sitting there, waiting for him to take a damn breath. I couldn't decide if this was one of the greatest conversations of my life or a hostage situation. I kept checking the time, and then, genius, he said, is the opposite of expectation. Genius, he repeated, looking at me with deep, knowing eyes, is the opposite of expectation. I didn't know what else to do, so I just jumped up and said, I might regret this one day, but I have to go. And before he could say another word, I sprinted off the bus. I dashed down the sidewalk, cut a left up the hotel's driveway, and spotted the town car. A driver in a suit and tie stood out front. While catching my breath, I checked the time. I had made it with a minute to spare. The driver and I made small talk while I kept my back to the car, glancing at the Westin's rotating glass door. Until finally, the chief of staff stepped out. He was holding a leather bag in one hand and a phone in the other. His hair was dark and thick with subtle streaks of gray, which perfectly complemented his blazer and black Ray-Bans. He approached the car and lowered his sunglasses. So, you must be Alex. I introduced myself and we shook hands. Please, he said, motioning toward the car. Come on in. We took our seats and the car pulled out the driveway. Tell me, he said, how is your project going? Oh, it's going really well, I said, and I began listing one thing after another, saying whatever I could to show momentum. So, he said, I take it you still want to interview Bill. I said it was my biggest dream. He nodded silently. Who else have you interviewed? I pulled out my wallet and took out the note card that had the names of the people I wanted to interview, with the ones I already had checked off in green. The chief of staff held the note card with two hands and slowly moved his eyes down the list, examining it like a report card. Ah, Dean Kamen, he said. We know him well. Larry King, he went on. That must have been an interesting one. As he was about to say the next name, an unexpected sensation overtook me and I cut him off. It's not about the names, I said, my voice louder than I'd anticipated. He turned his head to me, bewildered. It's not about the names, I repeated. It's not about the interviews. It's about, well, I just believe that if all these leaders come together for one purpose, not to promote anything, not for press, but really just to come together to share their wisdom with the next generation, I just believe young people can do so much more. All right, he said, slicing his hand up. I've heard enough. My whole body tensed. He looked at me, swung his hand down, and said, "We're in." Step 5. Take the third door. Chapter 25. The Holy Grail, Part 1. Bill Gates. Nearly everyone knows the name, but most don't know the whole story. Behind the nerdy glasses and magazine covers, there's the boy who read the entire World Book Encyclopedia at age 9. At 13, his hero wasn't a rock star or a basketball player, but the French Emperor Napoleon. One night at dinner time, he hadn't left his room, so his mom yelled, "Bill, what are you doing?" "I'm thinking," he shouted. "You're thinking?" "Yes, Mom, I'm thinking. Have you ever tried thinking?
Well, that might sound obnoxious. For some reason, I found it a bit endearing.
As I dug deeper into Gates's life, I started to see him as the most relatable, unrelatable person in the world. On one hand, in eighth grade, he spent his free time in the computer room with his friend Paul Allen, teaching himself how to code on the ASR33 teletype. That's totally unrelatable. While most kids in high school were sneaking out of the house at night to go to parties, Gates was sneaking out to go code at the University of Washington computer lab. That's even more unrelatable. On the other hand, he used his computer skills to help his high school automate the class schedules and rig the system to put himself in the classes with the best-looking girls. Now that's relatable. After high school, he majored in applied math at Harvard. Why did he choose that major? Because he had found a loophole. He figured out a way to get priority registration in whatever class he wanted because he claimed he was applying math to economics or applying math to history. Bill liked to rebel just for the sake of it, so he ditched the classes he was signed up for and went to ones he wasn't. The man the media portrays as an awkward, uncool geek was famous in college for staying up hours past midnight playing high-stakes poker. In his 20s, he blew off steam by sneaking onto construction sites in the middle of the night and racing bulldozers across the dirt. While he was starting Microsoft, he would take breaks from coding by climbing into his Porsche, flooring the gas pedal, and racing on the highway. And his love for speed wasn't limited to driving. As I read stories about him closing major software deals, I felt like I was watching a chess prodigy play 10 opponents at once, jumping from board to board, making dozens of moves a minute without blinking, beating them all. At an age when his friends were just graduating college, he was battling in the conference rooms of some of the world's biggest companies, IBM, Apple, HP, and negotiating contracts with people twice his age. With the chess prodigy metaphor in my mind, I realized that Gates has played the coding game, the sales game, the negotiating game, the CEO game, the public figure game, the philanthropy game, all at the highest levels, and has won each one. He grew Microsoft into the world's most valuable company in 1998, making him the wealthiest person on the planet. To put that in perspective, Oprah Winfrey is incredibly rich. So are Mark Zuckerberg, Howard Schultz, Mark Cuban, Jack Dorsey, and Elon Musk. Well, at the time I was preparing for my interview, Bill Gates' assets were worth more than all of theirs combined. After stepping down as CEO of Microsoft, Gates could have retired, lounged on a yacht, and enjoyed every material pleasure the world has to offer. Instead, he jumped over to new chessboards to take on even harder challenges. Feeding the world's poor, revolutionizing clean energy, stopping the spread of infectious disease, and bringing quality education to students in need. I already knew that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was the largest philanthropic foundation in the world, but I had no idea its efforts have helped save the lives of more than 5 million people. Because of how Bill Gates has chosen to spend his fortune, he's helped cut the rate of infant mortality in half. In the next 5 years, it's projected his programs will save the lives of another 7 million children. If there ever was a real-life superhero, it was Bill Gates. I used everything I learned about him to plan my interview. I wrote dozens of questions on my notepad and color-coded them by subject. From sales to negotiating, I felt I was creating my own treasure map. A week before my meeting with Gates, I went to breakfast with Larry King and Cal Fussman and asked for advice on handling the interview. "Just remember what I told you before," Larry said, pointing a finger. "The secret is, there is no secret. Just be yourself. And be just as relaxed as when you were here interviewing Larry, Cal said. When I left breakfast, I felt they didn't understand the kind of pressure I was under. I didn't have the luxury to relax. This wasn't just another interview. For the past 3 years, I had gone out of my way to stake the entire mission on this moment. I had sworn to my publisher, agent, and family that when I finally got the chance to interview Gates, I would draw out a piece of advice from him that would change my generation. Something that would radically transform people's careers forever. The Holy Grail. I needed help from someone who had done something similar. I had heard that for his book Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell had interviewed Gates for the 10,000 hour rule chapter. If anyone could relate to what I was up against, it had to be Gladwell. So I used the Tim Ferriss cold email template, and Gladwell responded a day later. From Malcolm Gladwell to Alex Spanayan. Subject, Mr. Gladwell, advice on Bill Gates interview? My advice? Bill Gates is the easiest person you will ever interview because he is exceedingly smart and direct and perceptive. Make sure you have read widely and deeply about his life so you don't waste his time. And then, let him talk. He will take you in surprising directions if you let him. Good luck. As much as I was grateful for Gladwell's encouragement, it didn't calm me down. The stakes in my head were too high and I was too intimidated by Gates to relax. I needed something to move him off the pedestal in my mind. I tried visualizing what he looked like when he was my age. I imagined him in a worn-in t-shirt and jeans, lying on his dorm room bed. A story I had read came to mind. It took place during his sophomore year at Harvard. Gates was 19 years old when Paul Allen barged into his dorm room and threw a magazine on the desk. "Bill, it's happening without us," Paul yelled. On the cover of the magazine was a smooth, pale blue box with lights, switches, and ports. It was the Altair 8800, the world's first mini computer kit. Bill tore through the article and realized that, although MITS, the company that invented the Altair, had already created the hardware, it still needed software. Microsoft wasn't even an idea at the time, but Bill and Paul wrote a letter to Ed Roberts, the founder of MITS, and offered to sell software to run it. Bill and Paul wanted to seem more legitimate, so they wrote the note on letterhead stationery from a company they had started in high school called Trafodata. A few weeks passed with no response, and Bill had to be wondering, did the founder of MITS throw the letter in the trash? Did he find out I'm a teenager? Years later, Bill learned that the founder of MITS not only read the letter, but he also liked it so much he wanted to buy the software. He called the phone number on the letterhead and a random woman answered. Bill and Paul forgot their letterhead still had the phone number of their friend's house from high school. They didn't know that though, so back in Bill's dorm room, they debated how to follow up. Bill handed the phone to Paul. "No, you do it," Paul said. "You're better at this kind of thing." "I'm not going to call," Bill shot back. "You call." I guess even the person destined to be the world's richest man suffered from the flinch. Eventually, they came up with a compromise. Bill would call, but say he's Paul. "Hello, this is Paul Allen from Boston," Bill said in his deepest voice. MITS was a small company, so he didn't have trouble getting through to the founder. "We've created some software for the Altair that's just about finished, and we'd like to come out and show it to you." The founder was receptive and said they can come out to their office in Albuquerque, New Mexico, to demo the software. Bill was overjoyed. He had only one problem. He didn't actually have any software. In the weeks that followed, Bill spent every minute he could coding. Some nights, he didn't go to bed at all. One evening, Paul walked in and found Bill asleep on the floor by the computer terminal, curled up like a cat. Another night, Paul saw Bill passed out in his chair, using the keyboard as a pillow. After 8 long weeks, Bill and Paul finished the software for the Altair. When deciding who should fly out to Albuquerque to make the pitch, they used simple logic. Paul should go. He had a beard. Paul boarded a plane with the software safely in his hands. As the plane took off, he mentally went over the demo and realized, oh my God, I didn't write a loader for this thing. A loader is the code that tells the computer, this is software. Without it, the code would be useless. Hunched over a fold-out table, Paul scribbled all the code on a notepad from brute memory, finishing just before the plane's wheels hit the ground. He didn't even have a way to test it. The following day, Paul arrived at MIT's headquarters, and the founder gave him a tour. They stopped at a desk with an Altair 8800 on top. It was the first time Paul had seen one in person. All right, the founder said, let's do it. Paul took a breath, loaded the software, and it worked. Paul and Bill closed the deal, signed the contract, and that's how they sold their first piece of software. For me, a single lesson stood out among the rest. Although his talent for coding was remarkable, none of this would have happened if Gates hadn't pushed through his fears in his dorm room, picked up the phone, and called MITS. It was his ability to do the hard, uncomfortable thing that made this opportunity possible. The potential to unlock your future is in your hands, but first you have to pick up the damn phone. Although that was a good lesson, I felt it was far from the Holy Grail. When I sat down with Gates, I would need to dig up an insight that was surprising, powerful, and life-changing, something no interviewer had gotten before. To me, the Holy Grail was a living, breathing truth. It's what motivated me to trudge through the mud the past 2 years. And now that I was so close, I was even more adamant I was going to get it. The morning before the interview, I packed my duffel bag, placed my notepad in my backpack, and headed to Seattle. Chapter 26, The Holy Grail, Part 2. I stepped down a golden-lit hallway, a single door at the end. An assistant asked me to stay put as she disappeared behind it, leaving me to stare at the towering, frosted glass door. I looked closer at the dark leather handle with silver trim, studying it as if it held a clue. Even the slightest detail could lead me to the Holy Grail. And because I didn't know where it was buried, no detail could be overlooked. After all, I couldn't just walk in there and say, yo, Bill, what's the Holy Grail? You can't do that. And you can't just hope Bill Gates will give you a clue. He's not going to point to a Buddha statue on his desk and say, ah, you see that Buddha? I keep it there to remind me of the secret of business. I would have to find the clues myself, and I wouldn't have much time. Because I would need to be fully present when our conversation began, my only chance to find visual clues would be right when I walked in. And then, in what felt like slow motion, the frosted glass door cracked open. Directly in front of me was Bill Gates, sipping a Diet Coke. He smiled and lifted the can as if to say cheers. Hey there, he said. Come on in. The moment I stepped through the doorway, I felt like I was on the 90s game show Supermarket Sweep. You know, the one where the contestants have to sprint through a grocery store, find the most expensive items, throw them into their cart, and then race to the checkout before the buzzer goes off. Except I had to spot all the details I could, memorize them as fast as possible, figure out which ones were clues that would help me find the Holy Grail, and do it all before we began talking. As Gates walked over to the sitting area of his office, all I heard in my head was, on your mark, get set, go! Gates' desk was made of wood. It was tidy. There were two monitors on top. Behind his desk was a tall leather chair the color of malt whiskey. Sunlight streamed through floor-to-ceiling windows, illuminating the glass of five picture frames on the wall. One was a photo of Gates laughing with Warren Buffett, another of Gates with Bono, and a third was a close-up of a mother cradling an infant in what appeared to be a third-world country. Below the picture frames was a polished oval coffee table with two books stacked on top. One of the books was by Steven Pinker, and I made a mental note, buy books by Steven Pinker. At either end of the sitting area were two ivory-gray armchairs, a brown couch in between. Gates sat in an armchair, and I noticed his loafers were black and round-toed with tassels on top. I made another mental note, buy loafers with tassels. He had on dark slacks and his socks bunched low. He wore a golf polo, relaxed fit, dark gold, almost mustard brown. My mental buzzer went off. So, is this your first book? Gates asked. His signature high-pitched voice was even higher-pitched in person, making me feel like he was genuinely excited to meet me. He congratulated me, saying he was impressed by the people I had interviewed. Then he asked how I met Chi Lu. Gates' chief of staff entered the room, greeted me, and took a seat beside me on the couch. I figure with 45 minutes, he said, we should probably get right into it to maximize our time. I placed my audio recorder on the table and glanced at my notepad. I thought I'd begin by taking Gates back to when he started his first business. I was reading about your Trafodata days from high school, I said. What did you learn from that experience that later helped with Microsoft? Well, Gates said, Paul Allen and I worked together on that. It actually was good for us because that was a very limited microprocessor. Gates started slowly, and then, as if with a flick of a switch, he shifted in his chair, fixed his gaze at the wall, and turned into an audio version of the World Book Encyclopedia in double time. The very first microprocessor came out in 71. It was the 4004, which could hardly do anything. Paul saw that and showed it to me, and he knew we couldn't do much. Then the 8008 came out in 73, and he asked if I could write a BASIC for that, and I said no, I had those dates wrong. 72 was the 8008, and 74 was the 8080. I had come searching for details, and now I was buried under an avalanche of them. We decided we could only do special purpose stuff, so we got a third partner who knew how to wire wrap stuff up, and it all came out of the fact that we knew people had those tubes that measure traffic on the ground and punch these funny paper tapes. We had always thought there must be a way to do that by computer. We had actually been getting people to process them by hand. We'd look at them and write numbers down, then card punch them, put them in a batch computer, and the avalanche kept coming, and I couldn't keep my head above the snow. So I went off to college, Paul got a job back there, and we kept discussing whether we should do hardware or software, when we should start it, and then eventually we started as a pure software company in 1979. We started the software company in 75. Yeah, sorry, 75. We moved to Seattle in 79. 10 minutes sped by, but it felt like 10 seconds. A pulsating fear spread throughout my body. What if the entire interview flashes by in what feels like 45 seconds? Right then, the office door opened. Sorry to interrupt, a woman said, poking her head in, but I have Jen on the line. She asked if I could get you. Okay, Gates said, pushing himself out of his armchair. I'll be back, he said to me. One sec. The chief of staff leaned over. Family, he whispered. It was like a rescue helicopter had arrived. The door shut. I slouched on the couch, letting out a breath. I frantically flipped through my notepad, looking over my questions. Is this helpful? The chief of staff asked me. This angle for the stories? I had asked the chief of staff to sit in on the interview in case I needed help, and now he was offering it. My first question wasn't thoughtful at all. At this point, I should have said, yeah, I could use some help, but I was too afraid the truth would make me look like an amateur. Yeah, I said, I think this is good. Okay, the chief of staff said. Great. I turned back to my notepad. If anything could lead me to the Holy Grail, it had to be a tactical business question. And probably something about sales. Without a doubt, the most important sale of Gates's life was the IBM deal he closed at its Boca Raton office in 1980. He was 25, and IBM was the biggest tech company in the world. Because